This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, and I'm Joe Palca, sitting in for Ira Flatow. Last fall, the government's Office of Management and Budget put forward a proposal for peer review of the science that goes into making important government policy decisions. At first blush, that doesn't sound terribly controversial. Of course it makes sense to have knowledgeable scientists review the research on which policies are based. But when the proposal first came out, critics charged that it could too easily be tilted in favor of industry or big business, that it discriminated against academic scientists. So last week, a revised form of the policy came out. It calls for peer review of what it calls, quote, influential scientific information, and does make quite a few changes to the way policy would have worked in its first draft. If you'd like to talk about that, give us a call. It's an important topic, and it's going to affect all our lives. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And if you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. Now, let me introduce my guests. John Graham is the administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, part of the Office of Management and Budget in the White House, and he joins me by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Hello there, Joe.
Hi. Next, we have David Guston, is an assistant professor in the Department of Public Policy, part of the Blaustein School of Planning and Public Policy at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. He joins me from NPR Studios in Washington. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Joe.
Okay. And finally, we have Granger Morgan, who is the head of the Department of Engineering and Public Policy and a professor in the Departments of Electrical and Computer Engineering and the H. John Heinz III School of Public Policy and Management at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Welcome to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Okay. So let's start with John Graham. And I think what we need to have you do first, Mr. Graham, is to go back and tell us how we got to this juncture. Give us a little of the history that brought this bulletin, I guess is the technical term for it, onto the public scene.
Well, I think the first thing to keep in mind, Joe, is that federal agencies vary enormously in how much scientific and engineering and economic expertise they have in their own employee staff. So we have to develop a culture of making sure that the best qualified people, whether they be inside the government or outside the government, ultimately have an opportunity to review very important, influential scientific and technical documents. Some agencies like FDA and EPA already have a very strong start toward good peer review processes. Other federal agencies do not have any real formal peer review policy at this time.
But if an agency doesn't have any kind of formal peer review policy, maybe you can tell me, but it seems to me, wouldn't that suggest they're not dealing with the kind of subject that scientists would typically get involved in? Or maybe you can tell me there's agencies like maybe the Bureau of Mines, for example, that needs peer review but doesn't have it.
Yes, I was only referring to the science-based agencies, and there are a lot of science-based agencies that still don't rigorously and routinely seek outside scientific input on their products.
Uh-huh. And what's the value of that? I mean, why would that be a good thing? I mean, can't you find the expertise within the government?
Well, one of the things that we find at OMB, because we review regulations when they're developed, is that many times science-based regulations, even if they're very well intended, if the scientific support for them is not developed adequately, ultimately the opponents of the regulation, whether they be industry or public interest groups, they can then work either the judicial process or the legislative process to second-guess the judgment of the agency. We feel in the long run a disciplined peer review process will make the regulatory system more durable and competent.
Okay. So let me turn to David Guston. You have been following these regulations as they were first promulgated and as they've now, or these rules or these proposals, I guess is maybe the better way to refer to them, as they were first proposed, and you had some objections then. Maybe you can tell us what they were and how they were addressed.
Well, let me start off by saying that I do think there's been significant improvement between the original draft guidelines and the current draft guidelines. And the original ones, I think, were very tilted toward a very scientific look at the way to make public policy, as well as a strange view of what it meant to be an expert and what it meant to be an expert who had a conflict of interest. And the issue, as you referred to it, actually is not new. There have been some legislative attempts to create regulatory peer review for a number of years, and that initial set of proposed guidelines seemed to come out of that legislative attempt in the sense that they shared a perspective that, for example, viewed academics who had been receiving grants from agencies like the EPA as potentially in conflict with the agency, such that they could not participate in an independent way in review, when the whole point of, or one of the major points of agencies providing grants to university-based scientists is to help develop competence among the university scientists such that they can participate in the regulatory process. It seems like the guidelines as they're drafted currently have made significant strides toward addressing that issue.
So in other words, now it's possible for a federally funded scientist who works on the environment first, let's say, but may not be involved in a particular issue, still help the EPA make a decision if the EPA decides that person's the right person.
That's right.
But, I mean, who does get the ultimately decide? Because, you know, I'm sure that inside science there's all kinds of jealousies and rivalries, even though we think of science as a more clear-cut world, there's still people who are going to have different opinions. How do you get to pick who's the proper peer?
That's a critical question, and at least the way the new guidelines seem to be drafted is that a lot of that discretion is going to be lodged in the agencies, although there seem to be some guidance from the agencies to use outside sources as well, like the National Academy of Sciences. I believe that the agency should have that kind of discretion if this is the route that we're going to follow in making sure that science has a strong voice in the regulatory process. But it's still this situation doesn't change, I think, from the current status quo, which allows people in political positions to influence the peer review process through appointments, through choice of scientists who may not necessarily be in the mainstream.
We're talking about how the government decides its science policy and what kinds of outside advice it should be getting. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call 800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Granger Morgan, I'd like to turn to you and ask, where do you think we stand with this issue now? First of all, do you agree that the government needed something like this in the first place, or were things working adequately, in your opinion?
No, I think something is needed, and I agree with Professor Gustin that there has been marked improvement over the initial draft. I think the current proposal is actually quite reasonable, and I think it's needed because in my experience, principally with EPA, but in a limited way with other federal agencies, there are a lot of folks across the agencies who don't really understand what peer review is and what its point is, that being to take a review of the science and get it exposed to careful critiques from a variety of different perspectives. And this current document serves as quite a useful tutorial on the importance of peer review and outlines what I think are some reasonable ways to go about it. Now, I have some much more fundamental concerns about the way in which science is being used or not used in regulatory policy that I hope we'll get a chance to talk about in the minutes ahead. But the specific document that is the focus of the discussion, I think, has evolved very satisfactorily and shouldn't cause much problem in its current form.
Well, now you've whetted my curiosity, at least. What are your fundamental concerns?
Well, there are a couple. First off, if I'm going to do science-based regulation, which this administration has quite rightly called for a long time, I've got to invest in science. That is, I've got to have some science to peer review. And unfortunately, the current budget for the U.S. EPA proposes a 26% reduction in basic research investments. It proposes that the research support to universities and graduate students be cut by something more than a third. There are similar reductions in a number of other agencies in basic research. And so, the first thing is that it's fine to have an improved scheme for reviewing science, but if one's not investing in producing the new science, it's very hard to do science-based regulation. I have some other concerns we can come back to later.
Okay, well, why don't we invite some of our listeners to join in this conversation. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255. And let's go to Gerald in Portland, Oregon. Gerald, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Oh, Jarrell.
Okay, I'm sorry.
My question is, why is industry-funded research considered a legitimate source of peer review in the first place? I mean, I have a background in science and know how dangerous some of
Jarrell, just one second. I have to stop you for one second. I'm not sure you're coming through our system, so I'm hearing you, but I'm not sure anybody else is. So please
not
stand
really.
Away for a second.
No.
We're
going to
try and fix that. Somebody's coming in. Well, actually, okay, I'm... somebody's coming in right now. But I think, Jarrell, if you can just hold on the line, I'll just continue to talk with our guests, and we'll try to come back to you as soon as we get this figured out. Hold on, please. We're talking about the whole necessity of having this kind of a project. Mr. Graham, maybe you can tell us where we stand right now in the process of getting these kinds of rules implemented.
Well, these guidelines have been put out for 30 days of additional public comment, and that's because we made substantial changes to the original draft in response to comments from the scientific community. But if I could just turn for a moment and relate to one of the points, I think good points, that Dr. Gustin made, which is that how do you handle situations like on biotechnology or on global climate change, where there is a range of opinion within the scientific community on a particular issue. And the stance that these revised guidelines take is that agencies should strive to make sure that there is a diversity of perspective among the peer reviewers within the established scientific discipline that's at issue, whether it be, you know, climatology or what the particular field is. So we think it's very important that agencies not have a simplistic view of science and think there's only one view on these very complicated questions.
Okay, I think we've fixed our technical problem. Jarrell, can you still hear me? Okay, so why don't you go ahead and ask your question again, assuming, of course, that we heard none of it earlier.
Okay, so my question is, why is industry-funded research considered a legitimate source of peer review in the first place, to go back to first principles? I mean, I have a background in science and know how dangerous and subtle a personal bias is, but the industry isn't biased. It's willing and able to rig the game. I mean, if the public was called on to comment on local police issues, we would discount the testimony from members of a crime family. I mean, a lying scientist is censored, and industry almost never. So why should any industry-funded study be given the same kind of stature that an academically-funded study is in the first place, regardless of whether or not it's peer-reviewing a government study or anything else?
I'd be happy to take that one.
Yeah, go ahead. Granger Morgan, yes, please.
Well, there is obviously a problem sometimes with industry-supported work, but there is also a great deal of high-quality science that goes on in industry, and it would be crazy to throw it out. Instead, what one has to do is look at it very carefully from the point of view of, was adequate scientific procedure used? The peer review proposal that we're talking about today, though, is not actually to talk about reviewing specific pieces of work. That would be done by journals when an industry or scientist submits a paper to publish in a journal. Instead, the topic of this particular proposal is to review overview assessments of the state of the field. So, for example, if...
I'm sorry, Granger Morgan, I'm going to have to interrupt your question because we need to take a short break, but we'll come right back to that. We'll be back after this short break. Stay with us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palka. We're talking this hour about peer review and science policy. My guests are John Graham, the Administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, part of the Office of Management and Budget. David Gustin is an Assistant Professor in the Department of Public Policy at Rutgers University. And Granger Morgan is Head of the Department of Engineering and Public Policy at Carnegie Mellon. And Dr. Morgan, you were just answering a question from Jarrell about the value of of, company or industrial science, and I wish you'd continue that answer.
Sure. I mean, one needs to be always suspicious of any new piece of science, and perhaps particularly suspicious when it's a piece of work done by somebody who's got a substantial stake in the answer. But I was about to explain that that work is not, individual studies are not covered under this. An industry scientist who does a piece of work would send it off to a regular journal and it would get published. If I understand the proposal correctly, this is more to have adequate reviews of assessments of the state of a field. So, for example, if the EPA is going to consider revising the ozone standard, the agency would write a review of the state of the science, and this peer review requirement applies to that. Now, if I'm wrong, Dr. Graham, I'm sure, can correct me.
Well, Dr. Graham?
No, I think that's exactly right. One other aspect of the comment on industry-funded research to keep in mind is that in the area of pharmaceuticals, for example, where there has been tremendous progress in this country in the treatment of certain diseases like coronary heart disease, and where it's believed that progress in medication has been a very powerful part of that progress, I think we have to point to the fact that it's not just the expertise in the industry that helped generate that innovation, but at the Food and Drug Administration, they have developed both scientists within the FDA and external science peer review mechanisms to evaluate that information. So even in that case, peer review has a very important role to play. And while the bulletin doesn't strictly apply to that situation, what we've learned in the science community from using peer review like that, we're trying to utilize in the areas where Dr. Morgan is referring to.
Okay. Thank you, Gerald, for your call. Let's go to Clark. Clark in North Carolina, you're welcome to Science Friday. What's your question?
Yes. Hi. I practice environmental law and have for about 20 years and wanted to make a short comment and then ask the panel to comment on a couple of issues. In my practice, it seems the more controversial the issue, and I've been involved in some fairly controversial ones, it's been my experience that it's sort of harder and harder to find what I would call true, pure scientific research. The one caller before who mentioned, you throw out industry-funded science, but the problem is that almost all science has to be funded from some source, and the source is going to have some perspective, whether it's EPA that might be interested in more regulation or an environmental group interested in a perspective or a business or an industry interested in a perspective. And it seems to me that it's harder and harder to get, if you will, funding without strings attached. So that's one issue if you could comment on. Second issue would be that more and more we hear about the so-called precautionary principle, which has gained more favor in Europe than in this country. But my own take on it would be that sort of the precautionary principle premise is that the glass is half empty and that we should have to prove that all possible negative impacts are not going to occur before we do anything new, whereas sort of the more American tradition has been to be optimistic and go ahead and identify known impacts, but go ahead with an uncertain new technology, whether it be biotech or a new form of generating power, et cetera, and figure we'll solve the problems along the way. I think there's value in both premises, but there's great tension there that I think impacts the regulatory process and the legal process. So comments on those two issues, I'd be interested in hearing the panel's observation.
Okay, well, maybe I can pitch this to David Gustin. Would you care to comment on either of those points?
Yeah, quick comments on both of them. I think first, to equate the potential biasing influence of government funding and industry funding is frankly wrongheaded. I think that the way funding is structured, particularly as the revised guidelines suggest through researcher-initiated grants, where it's the researcher who comes to the government, it's not the government's agenda very specifically, and a group of other scientists adjudge whether that proposal to do the research is a good quality proposal or not, is significantly different than industry funding that has a much more discretionary aspect to it in terms of, you know, what the particular agenda being funded is and how that support is continued after some findings may be released. And I think there are adequate examples of attempts by industry to fund selected areas and to, in fact, influence after research has been done to show that there is a difference that can be made. Second issue on precaution, you know, I'm not sure that I would agree that there's an American view of precaution versus a European view of precaution, but I would want to change the focus a little bit from the steps that are taken to questions about who it is that gets the benefits and who it is that's subjected to the risks of the new technologies.
Sorry, Clark, you were saying...
Yeah, I think that is a good point in terms of identifying the classes of people, if you will, or the environment itself, the aspects of the environment that potentially are positively or negatively impacted. And obviously, the better job we can do in that regard, the better off we all are. But it does seem that Europe, I don't know if they're, quote, ahead of us or not, but is different these days. Take, if you will, genetically modified organism research and actual production activity, and you have some of the EU nations banning products that have genetically modified corn, et cetera, in them. And there seems to be both a disclosure issue, which it seems like we in the U.S. are behind on, but beyond that, there's an issue of, well, at what point do you try that new genetically modified technology, not knowing the full panoply or range of possible adverse outcomes? And if you go to one extreme on the precautionary principle, you would say, well, you can't try it until you can truly have good peer-reviewed science that has addressed all identifiable long-term potential adverse impacts, whereas maybe more, if you will, the old-school view would be, well, go ahead and let it out there if there are no immediately obvious adverse impacts, and we'll figure out the rest as we go along.
Okay, Clark, thanks very much for that call. But I think it raises an interesting question. I wonder if I can pitch that to you, John Graham. How would it work under this new scheme if Monsanto was coming, I guess it would come to the USDA, FDA, and say, we have this new genetically modified tomato we want to plant and bring to the public? I mean, how would it be different under the rules that you're proposing versus what happened in the actuality?
Well, actually, the way the new guidance would work is industry-supported science, if it's going to actually be used by the federal government in a way where the federal government embraces its validity and then represents it as the federal government's position, that work would have to be peer-reviewed through the process that's described in the bulletin. There are some exemptions for some very specific kinds of activities like legalistic adjudications and that sort of thing. But the general idea is, regardless of who generates this data or knowledge, whether it be industry or universities, if the federal government is going to say, we believe this is right, we're going to put this out as our scientific view, at that point, before that dissemination occurs, they need to have a peer review.
Mm-hmm. Can I go back to just make one quick comment on the issue of precaution? He used the word different, and that's exactly the right word. I don't think it's the case that Europe is more or less precautionary than the United States. It's just that the U.S. is more precautionary than Europe in some areas, like, for example, fine particulates, which are thought to cause significant health effects. The U.S. is quite a bit more stringent on those than Europe, whereas Europe, as he correctly noted, tends to be more precautionary on GMOs. One problem with the regulation of GMOs is
just to remind people, that's genetically modified organisms. For people, that lingo doesn't always flow
off my apologies.
The tongue. Go ahead.
One of the things you worry about is that if you're going to plant, say, corn that's modified so that you can use herbicides on it, you have to worry about whether the genes will outcross to wild species. Well, the EPA does an analysis like that domestically, but they don't have the resources and mandate to do an analysis globally. And so part of these arguments are
about the adequacy of the review that gets done, but that's rather far afield from the topic of today's discussion.
Right, but it does point to some of the broader issues. But I want to stay in this arena just for a moment, because is there a presumption here that peer review is going to come to the right answer that the government can stand behind? Because at some level, either personal bias or other things is going to come into play. And the reason I'm asking this question is I've been covering a lot of to do with cloning and cloning research. And you can find across the board almost in the scientific community a consensus, or a very strong consensus, that cloning for the purpose of creating stem cells is a good thing. But if it comes through the peer review process, I don't see that as being adopted as a position of the federal government, no matter what a peer review committee
says.
Well,
but what peer review is supposed to do is to get all the legitimate scientific views considered. So, you know, you look at a document on a particular reviewing a particular field of science, and you say, look, there are these three important perspectives that aren't picked up and talked about in this document. And the final decision, as I understand it, in the case of this proposal, would rest with the agency that's doing the review. This is basically simply designed to make sure that all the science does get looked at and incorporated in the summary.
Well, let's just make sure that, John Graham, is that the correct way to view these rules?
Yes, but also to agree with your point, Joe, there have been studies of peer review in scientific journals, and those studies have often found, even on really crisp, you know, right and wrong questions, that peer reviewers don't always catch all the errors in scientific work. And on occasion, peer reviewers may introduce errors in work. So we don't mean to suggest that by, you know, creating this kind of peer review system, the government will always make the correct scientific determinations. We do feel over the long run, as you apply this process, you know, through all these agencies and as they learn from each other, in the long run, you're going to have more competent science most of the time. And you're also going to make the government's scientific position more credible and more durable in the face of political attack or litigation.
Mr. Palka?
Joe, yes, go ahead, Mr. Granger.
Two quick things. First, as I said earlier, there is the problem of having the new science to review. And if we don't make the investments for that, we'll be stuck with old science, and it'll be hard to move regulation forward. The second thing is that while I find this particular document quite satisfactory, there is a general effort to sort of increase roadblocks along the way to moving from science to regulation, which I do find somewhat troubling. If we make it hard enough to get from science to new regulatory judgments, we could really slow the process down. And I don't actually think this document is an example that will be serious in that respect, but I worry more generally about that process.
Okay. I'm going to pause for just a second to remind people that I'm Joe Palka, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. David Gustin, were you...
I wanted to chime in on Professor Morgan's last point. And I am very much in sympathy with the potential difficulty of delays in the regulatory process that might be encouraged by something like this. I'm not convinced. I believe that this version is, again, much improved over the last version. But in addition to the delays, and going back to Dr. Graham's last point about peer review not being perfect, not being a panacea, I guess that leads me to want to know why the existing array of, on the one hand, federal advisory committees in many of the technical agencies, and on the other hand, the public comment process is not sufficient to get the kind of both technical and political input that agencies do need to go forward with the regulatory process. And I'll leave it there for now.
Okay. Well, maybe, John Graham, would you like to respond to that? Or
certainly. I mean, one thing to realize is that public comment processes are designed to provide anybody in the public an opportunity to express a view or to offer scientific information. But a public comment process by itself doesn't assure that the most knowledgeable, most qualified people who have the experience and the skills to review a complex topic will be involved. That's the distinction between peer review and public comment. And I think Dr. Gustin's right. There are some existing scientific advisory practices that do, in fact, serve as models for the kind of peer review that the bulletin is trying to promote. And there's nothing in the bulletin that would prevent agencies from continuing the high-quality peer review practices they're already doing.
But there is a problem that many agencies simply haven't figured out the importance or don't even understand what peer review is. And so in that sense, I would argue that this document provides a nice tutorial and some guidance on how to go about undertaking such reviews, which I think pretty much everybody can agree are important to do before you go on and make decisions on the basis of the reviews you've developed.
Okay, we have time for one quick question. Chris in Grand Bank, Michigan, if you can ask quickly, we might get you on the air.
Yes, my question relates actually to a point that Professor Morgan was making, and I'm a EPP graduate, so I'm really pleased to be asking it, which is, do you think that this proposal is going to contribute to more data-driven discussions in the arena of public policy?
Okay, quickly, Dr. Morgan, because we really
don't
have
a whole lot of
time.
It should contribute to higher quality science in public policy, but if one doesn't make the investments up front in generating that science, it'll be hard to get much improvement.
Okay. I have to use my prerogative as host to ask one quick question that came up. Mr. Graham, when we were looking at this proposal, it specifically says that you're not exempting social science. But when we went further down, we found that the bulletin does not cover accounting, budget, financial information, including that is generated by agencies that focus on interest rate, banking, currency, securities, commodities, futures, and taxes. So is this do we have some protected areas still?
Well, there, that's a good point, and we do in fact cover the economic and the economic data and models that underpin major regulatory decisions. But a bunch of the stuff you're referring to there is certainly outside the purview of OMB's oversight. They haven't allowed us at OMB yet to tell the Federal Reserve Board what to do.
Okay. Well, that's where we have to leave it, I'm afraid. I'd like to thank my guest, John Graham, is the Administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, part of the Office of Management and Budget in the White House. Granger Morgan is head of the Department of Engineering and Public Policy and a professor in the Departments of Electrical and Computer Engineering and the John Hines School of Public Policy and Management at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. And David Gustin is in the Blaustein School of Planning and Public Policy at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Thanks to all of you for joining me thanks to all of you for joining me this hour. When we come back, we're going to take a look at tall trees. Stay with us.